The risk is not Evergrande itself. This is metastasizing into other areas.
China's growing real estate crisis.
One of the most common reasons for mass events in China is something to do with real estate.
Today's sit down with China expert Dr. Christopher Balding, a former professor at Peking University's HSBC Business School and Fulbright University, Vietnam. We discuss the Evergrande debt crisis, the hidden inner workings of the Chinese economic and financial systems, and Beijing's increasing aggression towards Taiwan. This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kellick.
Dr. Christopher Balding, such a pleasure to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thank you for having me on.
So Christopher, just recently, it's been leaked that the Chinese regime has tested a hypersonic weapon capable of delivering nuclear payload pretty much anywhere in the world. I don't think it hit its mark exactly, but it shows a pretty incredible capability that apparently we didn't know about in the West. I don't know if that's true or not. And then at the same time, we have, you know, headlines like this one. Washington hears echoes of the 50s and worries. Is this a Cold War with China?
Well, I think it's very difficult to look at the past decade under the rule of Xi Jinping, and specifically within the past, let's say, 2 to 4 years, and not already know that we're effectively in what I would term a Cold War 2.0. I think a lot of the intellectual difficulty a lot of people have in facing that is they don't necessarily want to face that again for understandable reasons. I think it's also the difficulty in accepting who your adversary is, really. If we were to look at China against, you know, various metrics of other countries that we would term like, you know, the Soviet Union or similar types of countries, you know, China pretty much fits. A lot of those types of metrics that we would be looking at. State-sponsored oppression, expansionary objectives in different ways. So I think it's very, very difficult to almost understand for me how one arrives in 2021 not already accepting that as fact.
Okay, let's talk about the hypersonic weapon now. Do you think that U.S. intelligence was actually caught unawares, and frankly, you know, the Western world was caught unawares as to the reality of the development of this, or as far along as it is?
I would be surprised if they were as surprised as the Financial Times report makes them out to be. I did not know that they were working on a hypersonic, or as China has now termed it, a space vehicle, a space test, but China has clearly been working on similar types of vehicles, similar types of weapons delivery systems. They clearly have been working on that level of advanced technology. So even if you don't know that they're working on that exact product, it is very reasonable to just take as a given that they're working on those general class and those general types of delivery system that can avoid American defenses to deliver weapons to American and other countries' shores. So I'm a little skeptical that we're as surprised as we're making it out to be.
Okay, well, so why the leak and why now?
It's a little bit puzzling, to be honest, because it was clearly what I would term an authorized leak. This was clearly not some whistleblower, or, you know, the report did not make it out to be like any whistleblower or something like that. So it's what I would term, you know, an approved leak. You know, governments have approved leaks where they want to make it sound like a leak, but, you know, they get in a room and say, okay, which reporter do we want to leak it to, and, you know, who are we going to give them to talk to, and stuff like that. It was clearly an approved leak. We don't see anybody from, let's say, the political side weighing in on this. This doesn't seem to match what we know about what the Biden administration has talked about or how they seem to be approaching China. So I'm skeptical that it comes from the Biden administration or any of their political appointees. It seems to come more from the defense or intelligence type of community. And this leads to the distinct possibility that if it was an authorized leak from the intelligence or department defense sector, that there is probably a, let's say, growing fission between what the intelligence, law enforcement, defense sector is seeing with regards to China and how they believe China should be treated, and how the political wonks in DC from the Biden administration would rather treat China.
So, you know, as you're just saying this, it actually reminds me something that I came across today in your Twitter feed. Elbridge Colby is saying, probably my biggest concern, urgent concern with Biden administration's China strategy is that they seem to be confused about our, quote, desire for this not to be a military conflict with the presumption that it will not be. And, you know, it references a piece that he's talking about. And your commentary is that the administration might just not be ready to accept this kind of a reality.
What I meant by that was, I think there is this misconception in the United States and a lot of other countries that whatever we do is going to impact China. Okay, so that if we behave in a certain way, this will alter their course of behavior in some material way. Okay, so whether or not we want to treat it as a Cold War, whether or not we want to treat it as a conflict, doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. How does China view the situation? How are they behaving? They are clearly behaving, not just with the hypersonic weapon, but if you look at across a range of other areas in defense and security, they view it as a Cold War type of situation and some type of impending conflict. We could look at the South China Sea. We could look at, you know, what they've been saying and how they've been behaving with regards to Taiwan. We could look at Hong Kong. Clearly, that gives us an idea of how they are viewing the outside world. So I think when Colby is saying that, we need to say, it doesn't matter what we think. We need to understand how our counterparty is viewing the situation and react to that.
So let's take Taiwan. Okay, so what does Taiwan tell us? What do these, you know, this dramatic increase in overflights and, you know, there's, I've been looking at various types of, you know, this merchant, weaponized merchant marine activity off the coast. I mean, there's a lot more activity. What is this telling us right now?
One of the things about Xi that I think is very clear is that he views himself almost with a sense of manifest destiny with regards to China. Okay, that he is the individual that will restore China to its rightful place, sitting as the unrivaled power in the world. That he is restoring China to its central place of power and control. And that is his job. He views himself very much, almost, even though it's not religiously accurate, almost as a messianic figure with regards to China. One of the things that he has talked frequently about is reuniting Taiwan and the mainland. And he said repeatedly that if you don't reunite with us peacefully, we will take you by force. So this is another one of those situations, first of all, where it is like, it doesn't matter what Taiwan or the United States do. We could say it in the nicest possible language. There is a predetermined viewpoint on the Chinese side. There's a predetermined course of action about what, you know, where they want to go and what the objective is. And either the rest of us get with that plan or we are the enemy. Okay? So what we're seeing with a lot of these situations, the increased activity, have to do with Xi Jinping's view about reuniting as part of this sense of restoring China to its rightful place as a type of almost manifest destiny. If you view it in that sense, I think it makes a lot more sense. Just recently, there were reports from satellite pictures that there are three new bases being constructed right along the eastern seaboard facing Taiwan. The general that is in charge of the Eastern Theater recently took that post up about 18 months ago, and he was transferred from the Western Theater where he oversaw Xinjiang, Tibet, and Indian-facing forces. And the reason that that is important is that the person in charge facing Taiwan is probably a trusted loyalist. is the indication. This is a person that was preparing troops to do battle. Now, we can say they did battle poorly in India. We can say things like that, but this does not indicate a movement that is, for lack of a better term, keeping the status quo. This does not indicate moving in somebody that is not highly trusted by Xi himself. So these all point in the direction that there is increasing pressure on Taiwan. Personally, I would expect that there's a material probability of some type of conflict between China and Taiwan, plus or minus 6 months of November 2022, because that is when Xi is expected to be, quote, reelected. So if he is being reelected for a third term, breaking the Communist Party mold of, you know, recent history, and part of his, let's say, re-election platform is to reunite Taiwan with the mainland, it's not crazy to think that there will be some type of conflict with Taiwan within 6 months of his re-election. Now, I should say, conflict can mean a variety of things. This doesn't necessarily mean a Private Ryan-type storming of the beaches. This can be a variety of approaches, but I do think it is very fair to say that there is a 30 to 40% probability of some type of conflict with Taiwan within, you know, plus or minus 6 months of his re-election.
So you're talking about election or re-election. No, there's been, you know, a lot of coverage in the past of him making himself dictator for life. And so what does this election really mean?
You know, it's funny. This is a big question. The reason that this is so important was after Mao, there was a major effort to limit leadership to two terms. And what was so notable about it was that even after Mao, even though he unofficially, you know, gave up power, he basically, everyone recognized him as basically the guy who ran everything, even though he wasn't necessarily the title holder. So more than Xi continuing, it is very important that Xi is breaking these norms. And I think one of the things, and this has been a little bit puzzling to me, and I think there's various reasons for it, but one of the things is that I think we need to readjust how we're seeing Xi and China. Is for many years there was this this overused proverb about, you know, bide your time. We treated China as a very conservative, and when I say conservative, I don't mean politically. I don't mean this term politically, but conservative in that they would not make, let's say, large movements or sudden movements. That it was, you know, a very steady as she goes, you know, we're going to get there in some time. And under Xi, a lot of things, I think he's a very ambitious and revolutionary, and I don't mean this in the traditional communist sense of revolutionary, but I mean revolutionary in the sense of willing to get rid of things that he didn't like, even if they went against, you know, maybe party orthodoxy or international opinion. Things like that. So we look at the South China Sea. He's militarized the South China Sea. We look at Hong Kong. He basically said, I'm taking Hong Kong. The term that was thrown about was, well, that agreement with the UK is just an old piece of paper. It doesn't mean anything. So if we look at even domestically, how he's, you know, remaking the party and dealing with political enemies, I would call him, he is not risk averse as a leader. He is very willing to smash things that he thinks are no longer useful or serve his objectives. And so I think we need to get rid of this idea that the cost would be too high, the risk is too much. I see little evidence that Xi and China under Xi is not willing to take those risks. I think they're very willing to take those risks. I think they're very willing to bear those initial costs. I think there might be some potential caveats, like if you start incurring large amounts of deaths, for instance, trying to invade Taiwan. But I think the idea that he is bound or restricted or conservative as a leader, I think just doesn't bear the weight of evidence over even the past few years, much less his entire time in office. And I think that would be true of China and the Chinese state.
I want to talk about, you know, the role of the Communist Party in Chinese society. And, you know, you started to speak to this a little moments ago. But before we go there, I actually want to get you to tell me a little bit about, you know, your background, because you have a pretty unique perspective on China and its economy and just how that evolved.
So I think what makes my specific background and viewpoint of China different and unique in a lot of ways is I never at any point set out to go to China, set out to learn about China. And so what happened was is I learned about China just living there, just being there. It really wasn't until I lived in China that I even really read books about China. A lot of ways experientially, what happened was is I learned about China by making the mistakes. Okay, like doing the things you're not supposed to and going, oh shoot, I shouldn't have done that. The first time we were ever in China was not because of me, but was because of my wife, who was an architect and pre-2008 Olympics was building some of those big homes and buildings in Beijing and other in a couple other cities around China. And so this was, by Chinese standards, a relatively open period, I think a pretty open period. But even then, unknowingly, we were surveilled and, you know, scoped out by security services of some kind. I mean, I did not ask for identification, but it became very apparent who was trying to ingratiate themselves with us. And so later when I moved back with a family at this time to take a job at Peking University, again, I went about and I started doing things and behaving, and it was through learning, oh, well, this is why things are done a certain way. This is how conversations take place. And I made the mistakes that, you know, a lot of people probably wouldn't make. And so you get exposed and you get taught about how society operates, how conversations take place. One of the times I'm most proud of, and I lived in China for about five, six years at this point, there was a meeting at work. And I don't even remember what the meeting was about. But in a lot of Chinese conversations, nobody will actually talk about what's being talked about. There's these conversations are rich with subtext. And so whatever this meeting was about, I went to the meeting and I was like, oh, I get what's going on. This is really the conversation taking place. And so I went to a colleague that was, I was a colleague with my entire time, dear friend, and I asked them, I said, is this really what happened in this meeting? Is this, I believe this is the subtext and what the conversation was really about. And they looked at me and they said, you now speak perfect Chinese without actually speaking a word of Chinese, okay? And so I felt that all of a sudden, by being able to interpret body language and subtext and all of these things, you get a much better idea for how a lot of these things that are so beneath the surface and not readily apparent unless you've maybe experienced it become apparent. And that really formed a lot of how I understand China.
But you chose to leave at some point.
I went there after the global financial crisis in 2009. And at the time with my wife, we said that we would stay as long as the job was still a good job. Realistically, I thought I'd probably be there 3-4 years. And I started having children, and those 3-4 years turned into 9 years in China. And really enjoyed China. My three children went to private Chinese schools. They got the, you know, the Chinese method of how you learn Chinese, you know, just write the words over and over again. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, when I hear Chinese parents talk about it, you know, I understand that more than, you know, the American schooling system, which I'm now being exposed to. And I'm like, this is so strange, you know. But we left after 9 years because I got fired for complaining about censorship at the time. There was some journals in the UK that had censored some journal articles. I raised this issue publicly and Peking University decided that it was time to end our mutual relationship. What was interesting was I started picking up in 2000, probably 14, 15, that China was really changing. And so when I was looking for a job actually in 2017, I started looking around and I started calling friends in Hong Kong, you know, hey, should I try and get something in Hong Kong? And what was notable was all of the friends and contacts I had in Hong Kong, universities, banks, other places, they said, Chris, do not come to Hong Kong. It is going to be a bad scene soon. It's one of those things similar to the hypersonic glider that I was a little surprised at the way things unfolded in Hong Kong, but everybody I talked to, you know, when I was leaving, basically indicated how bad things were. And so it wasn't an entire surprise. After leaving China for professional and personal reasons, I made my way to Vietnam, which was, I think, a case study in contrast, even for communist authoritarian government, just how different it was and how they've responded to, you know, similar histories. And I was in Vietnam for 2 years, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
And then you felt that you needed to, not too long ago, make it here. Why is that?
I was advised by a number of individuals that it was probably not going to be safe for me in Vietnam to continue publishing the research that I was doing on China. There are a number of known cases where China, let's say, disappears or makes accidents happen in China. There was a recent case where multiple individuals of senior Vietnamese military leadership were arrested for espionage for China. So these are, you know, China, and even though Vietnam and China are bitter enemies in many ways, there's also risks if you're going to be criticizing China, even in Vietnam. I came back last year in 2020 to the United States.
So was there some moment where you decided, because you're talking about your run-ins with state security, you're always kind of open-minded, wanting to learn, trying to understand the deal. Was there some point where you decided, I'm ready to say things which are clearly not going to work with this subtext that you're describing?
When I first started saying things about China, this was probably 2012, 13, something like that. And I was reading what people in New York City and Washington, D.C. were saying about China. And I was like, this is just not based in reality. This is not what is going on in the ground here. And this is one of my very common frustrations with a lot of what is written about China coming from Washington, D.C. and New York City, is these people have just not spent either any time in China or Vietnam, or if they have, they've spent a weekend at the Four Seasons meeting with senior executives from major companies or, you know, senior officials from the Chinese government. And having been to some of those nice hotels in Beijing and Shanghai, as well as other Southeast Asian countries, in a way, it doesn't matter where you are, because a Four Seasons is still a Four Seasons. A Ritz-Carlton is still a Ritz-Carlton. So you're not actually gaining really much of any information or knowledge about the country. And it was not reflecting what I was living on the ground in China. And that's when I decided to start writing about what I was seeing and witnessing in China.
I think I remember, you know, noticing some of that, and I was thinking, wow, like, this guy's actually doing this? How long is this going to last?
I always had the mentality, if they ever came to me and said, okay, it's time to go, okay, it's time to go. My personal identity, my professional identity was never bound up in, you know, maintaining that access. And actually, I was talking to someone who, you know, had to leave China and is not welcome back. And they said, you know, one of the things is that when you deal with China, you have to accept the risk that you will lose those relationships, that you will lose that access. But the price is that if you're going to maintain that, you have to say, accept, or do things that will eat at your conscience. And so I entered into it saying, hey, if they don't like something I write and they want me to leave, okay, there it is, you know, no big deal. You know, I've had fun. And so, you know, I think I started really writing about China in 2012-13, and I think I left in 2018. So to a degree of credit to China, they actually, you know, let me stay quite a while in relative terms. To a degree of credit to my boss, the dean at my school, I'm pretty sure he went to bat for me a number of times to you know, keep me there. And I probably would have been, you know, outed sooner if not for him.
What would be an example of something that you were seeing on the ground as a reality, maybe like the most stark example that you can think of that, you know, you saw, but New York and DC were seeing a completely different picture?
One of the things that pops to mind was one of the first papers I did, and this goes back to, this was probably 2012, 13, 14, I forget the exact timeline, but inflation was definitely running significantly higher. And this was at a time when one of the questions, there was a lot of suspicion that maybe Chinese data wasn't entirely accurate, but, you know, people were going to let it slide. And so I was looking around at price hikes in China that were significantly in excess of the 1 to 2% inflation that they were reporting. And so I was able to, you know, go out and, you know, say, guys, this just isn't what you're seeing on the ground. When I was in China, just to give you an example of inflation, you know, the prices by Chinese standards, I was in the top 1%. But the average price was probably far in excess of anything real estate price-wise that you would see in Manhattan or San Francisco, Silicon Valley, you name it. And so when they were talking about how great the economy was and consumer spending and everything, and you know, they were taking a lot of these figures as given, be able to go out and, you know, at times take pictures of prices and say, guys, this doesn't make any sense. I think that provided credibility and, you know, on the ground service. And I do think it is harder with, you know, a lot of the journalists that have been kicked out that aren't able to go out and do that and, you know, being pursued and surveilled the way they are today.
Fascinating. Tell me about the data then in China. Can we trust it?
So
how does it work?
There are a couple of answers to that, and I'm going to tell a couple of anecdotes. I was meeting with somebody who was a government official in China. This was before the crackdowns, you know, really started taking place. And I was told a story that somebody else that they knew that was another government official in a local branch of the Statistics Bureau got busted for selling the real data. They were selling the real data to people. This was at a time period when the corruption crackdown was really just starting to take off. So I asked this individual, I said, well, did they get busted for corruption or national security? And they said, oh, national security. We can't have that information out in public. And so just to hear the confirmation that there was real data and the fake data, I think was quite eye-opening from an official. You know, they know very clearly the targets that they have to hit. And there is enormous pressure to censor upwards. We always think of censorship as going downwards to the people, the state media and things like that. But there is also enormous censorship upwards of, you know, how information gets conveyed upwards. You know, nobody goes and tells their boss, you know, hey, we had a bad year this year. I think that is the first thing to keep in mind, that yes, there are absolutely different sets of books. I mean, Chinese authorities famously treat them as if there's two different sets of books. One of the things, however, that has become much harder for China is to fabricate data to such a degree that it doesn't match with other data. Let's assume you have a coal mining province or a town, or a province that has lots of steel. Okay, well, how do you make steel? You burn a lot of coal. Okay, what happens when you burn a lot of coal? You have lots of air pollution. So if we, for instance, can measure that the air is very clean this year, what likely didn't happen? Well, we likely didn't burn a lot of coal. Well, if it's a steel province, and you're not burning coal, that likely means that economic activity was down. What you're trying to do is you're trying to reconcile things that are much harder to fake to things that are easy to fake. So if those two numbers come close, and we're not looking for exact matches, but as long as they're like generally moving in the same direction, you know, of similar magnitudes, we say, okay, close enough. To borrow from the old supermodel phrase, you know, I don't get out of bed for less than 5%, okay? So what you're really trying to do is match data that the government publishes to, which is very easy to manipulate, to data that is very difficult to manipulate. Air, lights, things like that. We can measure air by satellites. We can, you know, we can measure lights, okay, by satellites, okay? There's different things. But you're trying to reconcile very manipulable data to very difficult to manipulate data. And that's actually become a lot harder for China. And the reason is, and so when I hear foreigners say, oh, well, Chinese data is actually pretty accurate, I say, Chinese don't believe Chinese data. And the reason is that basically every firm in China has gotten into the data business. Because real estate firms, okay, like simple real estate firms, realize, wow, I'm just leasing apartments. I actually have tons of data on how many empty apartments in my province there are. That's valuable data to people that are studying the real estate industry going, how many empty apartments are there? How often are people moving? If people are moving, they probably need transportation services. If people are moving, they're into new apartments, they're going to be buying couches, they're going to be buying refrigerators, things like that. And you see this with lots of firms. You see it with real estate. You see it with shopping malls. You see it with, you know, UnionPay and Alipay and all these guys, okay? So that, you know, if there's more transactions every month on Alipay, we probably can say, yeah, consumer spending is going up. So there's all these ways that people are inventing, and what this is telling us is that the Chinese don't believe Chinese data.
Well, it's almost like a data black market.
Yes, and not only is there this legal market of data, there is a very thriving black market of data in China in different ways. Whether it's, you know, if you know somebody at the National Bureau of Statistics that will sell you the real data. Chinese markets are widely known for abnormal price movements before big announcements, whether it's like a quarterly earnings report, whether it's like, you know, the grain reserves, things like that. It's widely known that these markets in China move in ways they shouldn't if there was a data blackout. Okay, so there's absolutely a thriving black market for data in China.
I think we have to talk about Evergrande here. This is something that's on everyone's mind. There's people that are asking, you know, is this, you know, a potential default? Is it something that could take down the global economic system? I've even seen that postulated. And there's other people that are saying kind of the exact opposite. This is not going to have any impact. The Communist Party's got their handle on this. Where do you land on this?
So I think there's a couple of issues with Evergrande. First of all, can the Chinese Communist Party control Evergrande as a situation? Absolutely. No question. Okay. They can.
$300 billion, apparently, right?
Yes.
Something of
yes,
that.
Yes, absolutely. And again, in economic terms, that's not a negligible part of GDP, but, you know, that's a very small percentage. You know, there's all kinds of things that they could do. They've done similar things with HNA, a bankrupt conglomerate, other issues like that. So they absolutely can just make this problem go away very, very easily. There are a couple of issues, though, with Evergrande that I think make it very unique. The size, yes, it's bigger than others. That's not the dominant issue. The real issues with Evergrande are this. I don't think anybody, even in China, really knows what their liabilities and operations are. They have how many hundreds and thousands of suppliers? One of their suppliers, an aluminum company, has announced that they basically are bankrupt. And that's their biggest aluminum supplier for, I think, a specialized aluminum product. They have literally hundreds of thousands of Chinese citizens expecting delivery of an apartment. Okay.
And some of those have been blown up, apparently.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, absolutely. Then you have all the suppliers that they have basically just written IOUs to. And that's assuming everything that they have said about their current state of operations and debt levels is completely accurate, which is, we all know, is not the case. Okay. So the first thing you have to ask is, what is their actual state of operations? And there's probably people trying to figure that out right now, as we speak, burning the midnight oil in China. And to a degree of fairness, anytime you have a mega bankruptcy like this, the first thing the accountants will do is go in and try to figure out what is actually there. Okay, what are the actual debts? And inevitably, in every case, even in good ones, you will find material amounts of liabilities that you didn't know were there. Not to mention behemoths like Evergrande, where I'm sure that there's going to be enormous amounts that they didn't know were there. The risk by Evergrande itself, they could go in, shut it down, problem solved. The problem you really have then to the Chinese economy, and this is where China is really, and this is where this censoring upwards and censoring downwards is really difficult for China, is the risk is not Evergrande itself. The risk is, and we're already seeing this, and this is where China is really running on a very dangerous tightrope. You're seeing Chinese citizens lose faith in real estate. Real estate transactions in China have plummeted. In Shenzhen, you know, they were down to a city larger than New York. You had less than 2,000 resale transactions. Okay.
Wow.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you probably do that just in, you know, a day. I mean, easily. Okay. I mean, imagine 2,000. I don't know how many. If I'm just ballparking off the top of my head, that would probably mean in a city, the entire metro area of Shenzhen, that's probably, let's say, roughly 5 million units off the top of my head. And that means they're doing 2,000 unit resale transactions a month. I mean, think about how many hundreds of years it would take to turn over that real estate stock. Okay. So, and the reason that matters is, with the sky-high real estate prices, if people start to lose trust in real estate, they aren't going to buy. If they're not going to buy real estate, the prices are going to fall. We've already seen announced reports where basically Chinese authorities are just saying, you can't lower the price. They've just declared you can't lower the price. If you look at the real estate sector outside of Evergrande, you've already seen real estate firms basically default, and others issue warnings that they're on the verge of default because banks are now scared to lend to any real estate firms. Okay, even for good projects, if there are good projects. We've seen the suppliers get caught up, not to mention Evergrande's aluminum supplier. There are other suppliers that are getting. So if you take Evergrande in isolation, they could snap their fingers and solve that problem. Because they don't know what's there, because they don't know, they don't have a game plan to solve this, this is metastasizing into other areas, other sectors, into the retail sector where people are buying apartments. They're saying, you know what, now is probably not a good time to buy. And that's where the real risk is. That's where the real risk is. People have faith in a bank because they can go there and get their money. If people lose faith in the bank, even if the bank can still has a good balance sheet, that bank is going to collapse because everybody wants to go get their money. So the real issue is, can they manage this so that people don't lose faith in other parts of the Chinese economy, whether it's real estate, whether it's that aluminum supplier, whether it's that cement company, whether it's that bank. We've heard rumors about Ping An Bank, which is located in Shenzhen, facing real difficulties. That's where the real risk is, not in Evergrande by itself.
That's fascinating. So speaking of numbers and data, the GDP numbers, or the official GDP numbers, are out. And I guess it's down from 7.9 to 4.9 in the GDP. So what does that actually mean for us, or mean for investors, or mean for Chinese for that matter?
So I think a couple of things. Basically, coming out of 2020, China actually declared that they were going to really push hard to make up for lost time. Because basically 2020 was not quite a lost year, but it was almost a lost year with Corona. And so their credit numbers in early 2021 were just astronomical. And so what we saw in the first couple quarters of this year was GDP growth really accelerated, and it was targeted heavily on construction, real estate, other infrastructure, things like that. That is where most of the GDP growth came from. However, as they saw inflation starting to rise, which is an enormous fear of the CCP, they really pulled back on credit, and they started pulling back on credit in, say, the spring, let's say the middle of Q2 in 2021, which would be, say, April, May, June type of time frame. And in China, what we say is that there's typically about a six-month lag from the time they're pushing or restraining credit till it, you know, shows up in GDP numbers and in real activity. If they were pushing credit in the latter part of 2020 and early 2021, it makes sense that there would be large amounts of activity in Q1 and Q2. And if they're pulling those numbers back in Q2, it makes sense that we would see that. And where we've seen the drop-off in economic activity is in construction, directly in construction. Whether it's, you know, train construction, we've seen cancellation of projects, or real estate, and we've definitely seen cancellation of projects. That's really where the drop-off in GDP is.
So it doesn't sound like to me like this in itself is an issue in your mind.
In many ways, no, it's not all that surprising, and I don't really think it has a lot to do with the current worries about Evergrande, because they started kind of tapping the brakes on credit growth earlier this year.
So is there a threat with respect to the economy, with respect to the global economy or the U.S. economy and China right now that you see?
I think there are a number of specific issues. So if we're taking real estate, I do think there is a risk to the economy, the global economy writ large. And that has to do with, you know, China is simply a wildly overbuilt country, and it is wildly indebted country because of that real estate. Chinese households are more indebted than almost any developed country household, and definitely more than any country even close to its level of income. The Chinese household is more indebted than the U.S. household, Russia or Mexico, which it compares pretty closely to in income, per capita income. And so that's going to provide an enormous restraint in the future going forward to consumption, to additional real estate purchases, things like that. And that's going to spill over into whether it's luxury goods, whether it's international mobility, whether it's international education, a lot of the things that China has become known for over the years. And you simply can't carry forward an economy with the levels of debt that we're seeing. And I think one thing is they say, well, you know, the United States has high levels of debt. You know, Japan has high levels of debt. China has high levels of debt. So it really shouldn't be that big a deal. But that really overlooks a very key issue. Debt servicing, how much it costs to pay back that debt as a percentage of Japanese national income, because Japan has, depending on the day and, you know, what traders are doing, Japan has basically, you know, almost a zero cost to carry that debt because their interest rates are, you know, zero. So even at like a quarter or 50 basis points for a lot of companies that they might have to pay, that's a very low cost to the national economy. The official rate in China to the 10-year government bond is 3%. Okay, so if you think about leverage, you know, you're already taking up, you know, let's say 15% of GDP by the time you count non-government debt and those other issues and how much it costs to service that. You're talking about 15% of GDP to service that, where in Japan it costs 1% of GDP. Okay, so it's very different when we're saying, well, you know, these other countries have high debt levels. China, for a number of reasons, is a very different case.
Well, do tell more, okay?
So one of the issues, and I think an economist that I admire greatly, Michael Pettis, who has lived in Beijing for many years, he raises the issue that Chinese GDP is what he terms, it's not an output, it's an input. So when we think of GDP, we basically, you know, U.S. statisticians will say, well, Americans, you know, did this this quarter, they produced this many widgets, you know, we produced this many hamburgers, and so this is what our GDP is. Chinese GDP is an input. So just as a company will have sales target, you know, we need to increase our sales this year 10% or, you know, something like that. China will, Chinese bureaucrats will sit down and say, well, we need to increase our government revenue at the provincial level, you know, 8% this year, and we need to increase GDP this much. Well, the easiest way to do that is through infrastructure spending. Okay, it creates steel jobs, it creates cement jobs, it creates labor jobs to do that, it creates service jobs for architects and things like that. And so it that's a very tangible way that the government can generate GDP. Okay, research and development for, you know, technology is a very difficult thing to do. It's a very unpredictable thing to do. Whereas if I give you money to build a bridge, I see that that cement's getting produced, and I see that that bridge is going up, and I see that that results in, you know, a flow to GDP. That has been the Chinese business model to achieve elevated growth rates for the past probably really quickly approaching 15 years. Okay, because what happened was, and I remember this was the first year I was in China, coming out of the global financial crisis, they needed to make sure that that they were cushioned from that downturn. And so they actually increased spending. And so I remember at one point, the first year I was there, and I remember it was one of the first articles I read in the local Shenzhen Daily, and I was like, this doesn't seem right. As I went and actually checked the data because I was like, this is crazy, is new loans in 2009 were increasing at four times the rate of the previous year. Not 4% higher, not 40% higher, four times greater than the previous year. Okay? That's an astronomical number. Okay, and so what happened in subsequent years is they said, geez, unless we want significantly lower growth rates, we have to keep increasing credit growth significantly higher. And so one of the issues that you might may have heard talked about is this issue of Chinese deleveraging. Mm-hmm. And China's talked about deleveraging. Well, just to put it in perspective, so this year, a number that they call total social financing, which is basically a metric of all debt outstanding, is up more than 10% this year. So nominal growth is probably going to come in with the first quarter, just off the top of my head, I would guess probably around 7% or something like that. So it's still growing, the debt growth rate is still growing far in excess of nominal GDP, which is increasing the amount of outstanding debt faster than how fast they can actually pay it back. That is the fundamental concern, that they're not able to generate GDP growth without major increases of debt far in excess of GDP growth rate. And those numbers simply cannot continue.
Well, so this is a very interesting question, because you wonder, there has to be some inflection point here.
I think if you wanted to say that there was a real storm, you could make a very good argument that there is a real storm surrounding and in the Chinese economy. You've got Evergrande, you've got all these all the debt that is out there, you've got potentially falling real estate prices. I did some back of the envelope math. Real estate prices have already fallen enough that the household wealth effect has dropped probably equal to about 7% of GDP this year. So that's a pretty significant number. You could very well make a case there would be a financial crisis issue. I generally, for many years, have taken the viewpoint that that is, at some point, those numbers will have to reverse. I mean, they simply cannot go on like that forever. So it will have to stop. I have taken the stance that it is basically a political question more than an economic or financial question. I was discussing this with somebody I consider somebody who knows, you know, much more about the Chinese economy than I do. And we were discussing the possibility of a financial crisis. And they looked at me and they said, no, there's not going to be a financial crisis. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, if there ever is a financial crisis, in authoritarian states, if there is a financial crisis, it does not end well for leadership. And this is the existential question for China. Just as Xi believes himself to be a man of manifest destiny, one of the other aspects to his belief system is that he does not want to repeat the mistakes of the Soviet Union. And he does not want to preside over the collapse of China. There is no check too big that he will not write at the end of the day. There is no bailout too large that he would be unwilling to bail out. Chinese leadership can talk about wanting to introduce, well, you knew what you were buying, you know, the government didn't guarantee that wealth product, that, you know, the government doesn't guarantee real estate. But what happens when real estate prices in China drop 15% and all of a sudden people are rioting because, you know, or protesting because they can't sell their apartments, that they can't make their mortgage payments? He will change his mind very, very quick. He's not going to be the leader that tolerates people on the streets protesting a fall in real estate. And actually, if you look at the data, one of the most common reasons for mass events in China, their word for protests or riots or things like that, is something to do with real estate. That absolutely just takes us to the point of, do they want to bail it out? And at the end of the day, Xi doesn't want to go into exile in the Maldives. He wants to live out, you know, his days as the emperor in China. And how do you do that? You bail out companies in China rather than tolerate dissent.
You know, it's often said, a number of guests on this show have said, that the CCP is incredibly dependent on U.S. dollars. And as you're describing this whole situation and this, you know, accelerating debt, I can't help think back to that and this sort of, you know, seeming interest to pump more money into the Chinese economies by some of these, you know, giant funds, for example.
Yeah, so the Chinese economy still is, I mean, basically, they will talk about the internationalization of the RMB and other things like that, but it is still an entirely dollar-dependent economy. The RMB is basically on par with North Korean won, okay? I mean, you can't escape that. I mean, outside of China, it is not widely used. And if it is, you know, when you look at the payment statistics about RMB, what you're typically talking about is something akin to like a Chinese subsidiary or something like that. There are really basically no transactions, international transactions, that move across borders that are processed in RMB. The Chinese economy is basically entirely dependent on dollars, and it has to keep that flow going. And there's enormous leakages in how Chinese get money out of China and get their wealth out of China. There's really an entire cottage industry in capital control evasions to money laundering to other things like that. And it comes in a variety of different ways, and it fluctuates depending on interest rates and other things like that, how tense politics are. I remember, you know, one of the very common ways to move goods, and they were doing a lot of this at different points when I was in China. They would literally, you know, sell goods into Hong Kong at one price. That truck would turn right back around, basically, and resell the goods back to China at a different price, just so the net effect would be moving money to Hong Kong. That was the entire purpose of the transaction, okay, was to move money to Hong Kong. One of the things is a lot of companies in China, they will be able to get money out of China for like to fund an R&D lab or something like that in a foreign country. Now that R&D lab may be a four-bedroom house in suburban Los Angeles or Palo Alto, but you know that gets labeled in the foreign exchange transaction book as an R&D lab in Palo Alto. I knew an individual in China that worked as a special assistant to the CEO of a not insignificant company. One part of his job was to buy real estate for the owner in different major cities, luxury real estate, structure it in ways so that it would pass Chinese currency exchange regulators. So for the past couple of years, we've seen China declaring these enormous surpluses. Enormous surpluses. But during that time, foreign exchange reserves have basically been flat. Just mathematically, if your surpluses are going up and up and up and up, why do your reserves, or let's say your savings account, just stay flat? Doesn't make any sense. There's enormous leakages. One of the questions then becomes about China is, are their foreign exchange reserves really trustworthy? Well, if China is so ebullient about their level of dollars, if they're so happy and, hey, everything's fine, dollars are fine, foreign exchange reserves are fine, currency reserves are fine, why would they let foreigners invest in the stock market and in government debt? Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Okay, so one of the very reasonable ways to interpret their desire to get foreign money in is that they need those extra dollars. They need those extra dollars. And I think one of the problems as an American that is so deeply problematic about those flows is not only are they going to a clearly adversarial state, but most of those funds are going in the form of what they call passive investing, indexing. Basically, there are companies that are included in an index. It's basically all the major, you know, the top 500 companies on the stock market. Every dollar that goes in gets divided equally between every company. Now, the problem with that is that doesn't strip out Chinese military companies, Chinese weapons companies, Chinese, you know, down the line, Chinese companies that are involved in Xinjiang. Okay, all of these types of companies. It just throws the money into the stock market pot, for lack of a better term. And so what you've seen is a lot of everyday Americans, a lot of this is done through pension funds, 401ks, so that when, if you're a teacher, the U.S. military retirement fund only recently took these options off the table. The U.S. military 401k and pension funds were investing in Chinese military companies by sending money through index funds to China. We are actually helping fund a very real enemy.
I want to get back to the question of the role of the Chinese Communist Party, because everything we're discussing here has to do with, you know, some sort of central authority making some pretty profound decisions affecting society, and of course, well beyond Chinese society. So tell me about that.
I think one thing as an American is that it's very difficult to understand just how central the CCP is to everything in China, at all levels of life. At all levels of life. You go into an apartment building and there will be the party representative. You go into a school, there will be the party representative. Every organization of any size you could possibly think of, there will be a party representative. It's not like, oh, this is just somebody who shows up. In most any organization, they are effectively the power that be, so to speak. The CEO might make the business decisions, but the party representative, who is frequently the CEO in large companies, will also determine, you know, what the workers do and, you know, the songs that the workers sing and, you know, all of these types of things. The party's influence, I think, to an everyday American just is not something that is even comprehensible. You know, if you're an American and you choose to ignore politics, you know, nobody really cares, okay? You don't have a party representative determining your HOA. You know, you don't have a party representative telling the school board, actually, this is what you need to do, and the school board follows it. It is really difficult for just an everyday American to understand the centrality and importance of the CCP in everyday Chinese life. Chairman Xi holds many titles, but the only title that really matters is that he is the chairman of the Chinese Communist Party. He is the head of state of China, but the title that matters in China is not the head of state. It is that he is the chairman of the CCP. Everybody, even the head of state, is answerable to the Chinese Communist Party. Okay, and I think that is something that is lost even on many Americans, and it took me a while to understand just how central that role was.
So the CCP is supreme at every level of society, bar none. You know, you mentioned Xinjiang, and you mentioned, you know, the party secretary being everywhere. There's a whole kind of another layer now, a technological layer, where, you know, basically it's become a surveillance society with a social credit system. And it's not even just within China that this technology is applied, but now it's being exported.
I think another thing, as a lot of Americans don't really understand, is just the degree of surveillance and intrusion into the privacy of citizens that that the Chinese government has. There are databases where we can literally watch, you know, Chinese citizens go about their daily business and really just follow somebody as they, you know, throughout their day. From the time almost that they wake up in the morning till the time they go to bed. There will be basically one camera or two cameras for one camera for every two Chinese citizens. Okay. So basically from the time you leave your apartment, you will be surveilled. From who you interact with, in many cases, you know, what you are saying, the information you are texting to people is all there for people to look at. Okay, there are no restraints on the Chinese government to surveil you, to control you, and they do get marked absolutely for sensitive content, thought problems, the degree of severity, all of these types of issues. And this occurs for how China surveils international individuals. We've heard about like the government hack of OPM, but in today's society, as individuals put things on the internet, this is why China gathers all kinds of data from social media platforms. This is why I do not put, even though I have a very active social media account, I do not put any what I would consider personal information about the names or pictures of myself. People know my name, but I do not put my picture on social media. I do not put information about my family, pictures, names, other things like that on social media. I can tell you the Chinese government highlights individuals that have security clearance. They use these platforms to recruit individuals, to highlight individuals that need targeting. And this feeds into their information gathering about what businesses have information we need to obtain. So that could be turned over to a hacker, things like that. There's this concept in China of what we call civil-military fusion, where the government works hand in hand with business. In the United States, there are businesses and, you know, parts of Microsoft or AWS who provide cloud services to the government may bid on a government contract. Google and those other companies actively fight and are actually very proud of their efforts to fight, you know, government intrusion into their users' data. Okay. Now, we can debate how much they do, and they absolutely have to respond to, you know, lawful requests for warrants and things like that in what we call a warrant management system. We've never found any evidence in Chinese databases of warrant management systems where there are controls over data that block who has access to information unless you input the necessary. It is simply there for government officials to access whenever they feel like it. So I think as an American, very similar to the CCP, it's very difficult for an outsider to understand just how much control you are under, just how much censorship. You know, they have scanners, they have facial recognition that can tell if a child is in class, if they're tired, if they're paying attention, okay? These are the levels of control that they're exercising that I think we as Americans, not just with regards to China, though definitely with China, that we should be concerned about with the level of government control, because, you know, you see the technological tools available here in the United States. And something we should be aware of, not just with China, but also with the United States.
There's a lot of questions, I guess, about how best to deal with China, all the way from, you know, decoupling the economy entirely to, you know, and then, of course, there's a contingent that's pushing engagement as well. And I think this is kind of playing out in the government as well, these varied perspectives. What would you, as we finish up here, you know, suggest, given these realities, especially the economic realities, for a good direction for the U.S. government in terms of dealing with the CCP?
We've clearly seen that China is not a reliable trading partner. We see this in how they treat other countries. We see this in how they've treated U.S. firms. We see this in how they treat their citizens. We see this in their aspirational targeting of countries like Taiwan. We see this in what they've done with Hong Kong. We clearly need to accept some of the costs to either impose costs on China or accept some of the costs to change behavior. We should decouple to the extent that we should work with companies or other countries to shift trade away from China. That could be Mexico. That could be Vietnam. That could be India. That could be European countries. That could be African countries. A lot of the manufacturing that we're talking about, especially the lowest of the low wage garments, you know, textiles, things of that nature, could easily be moved to other countries like Africa, Latin America, things like that. I think that would be a very advantageous, and that's going to take American leadership in different ways, from the government as well as the business sector. I think electronics is another area where it's very important to move away. Somebody that I know well put it this way: Chris, I've seen enough of this that if there is something China can hack, they have. I'm beginning to think that that's probably not a strong enough statement. Because China has clearly shown time and time again that they will absolutely, whether it's hacking, whether it's devices that are implanted with malware, all the way through to withholding key inputs, they absolutely have no qualms about doing that. And those are not people that we should be forming the cornerstone of an American trading relationship with. One of the things that I think you're starting to see a change in mentality to when we're talking about decoupling is there was this idea that, well, you know, they have these supply chains in China that are just so ingrained now they can't be changed. And Apple has now started an iPhone manufacturing plant in India, and it is churning out lots and lots of iPhones that are being flown all over the world. Okay, clearly the iPhone is a little bit of a unique product in different ways to make that happen so rapidly, but it's clearly dawning on people, yes, this can be done. We don't need to be manufacturing in China. And in fact, if you look at the longer term outlook, in 2021, we probably want to be in the Indian market. It's growing more rapidly. It has much better demographics. We want to be in that market. The political battle taking place is this administration has not recognized yet the costs associated with being willing to impose or accept those costs to change behavior. So I think the administration needs to look seriously at how to impose costs. Secretary Raimondo from the Commerce Department talked about, we want to engage with China. I'm not against engagement with China. It needs to be on our terms, and it needs to be with costs imposed for lack of adherence to the rules and laws of trade and business. And I don't think that's something, however, that we've seen this administration have the appetite to do, whether it's in the trade sector or in others. They seem distinctly unwilling to impose serious costs or show American leadership to say, we're going to be willing to take policy directions to engage with allies to move that trade away from China so that we are building up other allies and reducing our risk and exposure to China.
Well, Dr. Christopher Balding, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me on.